dropped.
All right, we were up to with the discussion. The next part of the syllabus was Kinah, Kasuv, and Tikkun Sofrim. So we start the discussion with a passage from the Mechilta, the Sifrei on Bamidbar. The Sifrei on Bamidbar. You can actually read the just from the second brackets. V'chein hu omer. Who has prepared and would like to read? This is on the syllabus, isn't it? Jeremy, want to read? Start from V'chein hu omer. Near the bottom of the paragraph. It's bracketed. I asked Jeremy to read. Number 18. Vavasay now. Ela Shekina Hakosev. So what is the pasuk in Zechariah saying? Kihan ogebachem, one who strikes like out against you. Kino geb the vavas. Eino is like one who strikes some part of his eye, his eyeball or something like that. So what does Rabbi Yehuda claim the pasuk really means? What does he claim it really means? Ela shekino hakasav. What does kino hakasav mean? Euphemistically. So what should it have said? He says basayin, he doesn't mean basayin. He didn't want to say what the literal meaning should be. Basayini. Meaning, kivayachal, as if one who strikes out against you is one who strikes out against me. But that's not exactly covered, klape mala. And therefore, kino akasav, and the yud becomes a vav. Eini becomes a no. Okay. Now, who changed this? What are the two choices? We touched upon this already, Adi. Call Ezra if you want to call Ezra later, or Zechariah himself wrote it this way. Now, from the pasuk, from the language Shekino Hakasav, which of those two would you think is more likely? Zechariah. It's more likely. It just means it's the original author's euphemism. Okay. Continue. Lama samtani mifgaloch v'ayeh. So Eov says to God, why have you made me a target for yourself and I am upon myself for a burden? So what does it mean? What does it really mean? What's that? A burden upon you. And to speak as if something is a burden upon God is not, kivayachal, how can that be? And therefore, the pasuk reads, vayeh olai lamasa, navayeh olech lamasa. In some of these cases, in this case, Ibn Ezra and Mitsudos, various parshanim suggest readings, interpretations that don't require adopting this phrase approach, meaning you can read the pasuk without seeing it as a euphemism. Not all the cases, some of the cases it's going to be obvious, but some of the cases the Mefarshim will read with ignoring in effect the sifrei, pointing out how one can read it not as a euphemism, but simply as a shot without that seeing that the Czech text was somehow changed or euphemized. Okay, go ahead. Okay, this is from one of the more ignominious, I think I've said this before, and that word sounds, I don't use that word too often, ignominious events in Jewish history. Yechezkel is brought in the visions, he's brought in a vision to Eretz Yisrael to witness what they are doing in the Mikdash, and they are bowing to the sun facing east, and the way Chazal understood, they were defecating towards the Mikdash. Either way, so Shalchemes has an Ora El Apam. It's not clear what the expression means. Whatever exactly it does mean, it means they were doing something to, well, so that the Tikkun Kina Kosov is, it should have been Vinei Shalchemes has an Ora El Api. And the Navi didn't want to write it that way, so he wrote Shekina Kosov. Tayotebo. Elokai. Right. So you. So what should it have said? This is Habakkuk speaking about God, how you are, in effect, our eternal hope, and he says, "V'lo namus." So again, the Radak there doesn't read it this way. He doesn't read it as a kinakas, he reads it as kipshat, because. Probably because you protect us, so therefore we won't die. But, yeah, it means, in other words, you're eternal, not like us. So we can always depend upon you. We can always depend upon you. Where is the pasuk? It's not Aleph Yud, is there? It's not, it says that, but it's, I don't know, it's Midrash Beis, it is Aleph Yud, hold on. Yeah, Elokai Kidoshi Lonamus. Okay, so he reads it as Lotamus, probably, yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't understand why that, why there's any reason to make that a euphemism.
So, I said, in all these, in many of these cases, not all of them, you can argue, to make a case as to why it is that the pasuk, the way it reads, is not a euphemism. So, but they thought it was. They thought that really, if he's speaking to God as if you are from every, in other words, Atami Kedem Hashem Elokai Kidoshi, and the Lo Tamus, from one end to the other.
What would be the Bible is to say Lo Tamus?
Well, because you can't even speak about death in the context of God dying. Even the whole notion of raising that issue, I didn't understand what you meant, raising the issue is blasphemous. In the same sense, well, okay, that's a little worse, but still, the notion of speaking about God in the context of somehow, well, God won't die. Well,
he's eternal. No?
What's that? No, I understand, but apparently the notion that you would utter the, we, even though we say God is eternal, we don't say God never dies. Okay, I can see why it would have bothered them, but okay. Anyway, bottom line is, it's also not compelling within the pasuk itself, but, okay, that's how it's read. Kayotebo. The pasuk from Tehillim. What did they do? What did the Jews do? What is this a reference to first? Ve'egal zav. Vayamiru is kvodam misavtin shor ochal esef. Okay, and what is kvodam? What is supposed to be? Kvodi. They exchanged my honor, my presence, for an ox that eats grass. Ela shekina kasev. Kayotebo. Hargani na harog. Okay, Ella. Now, what should it have said? So why do you say that? No, it's definitely not talking about the Egel Zav. You know, he said Rasa. That's not unreasonable, but there's another, you did say, right, Rasa. There's another way of reading it, another different way of euphemism. What is, and you know what this is in the context of? Yeah, it's in the context, it's among the Mislon and Baloska. Right, but Akadosh Baruch Hu tells him what he's going to do in terms of giving them meat and then slaughtering them, and he says, "Imkachad osali, hargeni na harogim matzasi chemeinecha v'al ereh." So I would have read it some. That would have been a reasonable reading. Now, Let's leave that one sort of hanging, because that's a little bit difficult, not totally difficult. It could be either way. Why would it be God's bed, God's, why would it be Ra'asecha? So it could be either he didn't want to see God performing an evil act, or perhaps it's linked to the idea of if God were in fact to wipe them out, so then Lama Yomu Mitzrayim Lamar. Okay, I'm not sure which of those, but so those are sort of the two options, Ra'asam and Ra'asecha. Continue, one more case. No, two more. At least two more. Same thing. Enemy could be below your will. It should have been, but fine. Kayotze bo. Vayechel chatzi v'saro. Ela shekina kasser. That's the most difficult one to figure out. What should it have said? Vayechel chatzi. Almasi kamei sasher v'tzeiso meirechem. Imo vayechad. So Rashi, I think, suggests it should have said imenu. It's not klapei mal anymore. It's Moshe Rabbeinu speaking by Miriam Saras, says to God. I'm not really sure that doesn't why that's the worst thing in the world. You know, if that's what Moshe Rabbeinu really meant, why it's the worst thing to say. It's very hard to figure out exactly what the euphemism is in the last one. But putting that one aside, what is the common denominator between all these examples, it would seem? Two things. From a substantive perspective, Kina HaKasov is always protecting God's honor or speaking in a certain way of God, except for perhaps the second to last. Well, the last one was unclear, so I can't comment. And there's one other common denominator, which you might not be struck by at first, about which Professor Lieberman had a very interesting comment. Yeah.
Seems to be all about bad things happening.
Well, that's why you have euphemism. That's true, but something about the nature of the euphemism, Aaron.
Each one you're just changing.
Almost each one you're only changing
one letter.
One letter. Okay. Sometimes it's I don't know if you call it the possessive, but you're changing for the pronoun. And you're only changing one letter each one. Lieberman had a very interesting suggestion. I think it's Pshatel, but which is not usual for Lieberman. But Professor Lieberman suggested, there's a Gemara in Yevamos, I think it's Dafayin Tes, where the Gemara says, regarding David's decision, right? You know the story of the Givonim who refused to forgive. There was a famine. There was a famine in Eretz Yisrael for 3 years, and there was a famine for three years. And they wanted to know why, so they asked God, and God said, El Sha'ul ve'el beis ha'damim al asher ha'imisis ha'givonim. So there were two things that seemed to have been an issue there, but one of them was the givonim who might have been somehow killed or harmed or something in Sha'ul, when Sha'ul wiped that ear of Anovir HaKohanim. So they had to appease the Givonim, otherwise there would be no rain. So David went to them and they asked them what they wanted. The Givonim were the people from Yeshua's time who had sort of secretly or tricked the Jews into converting and accepting him. So they said they wanted 7 members of Shaul's house, and Shaul's descendants to kill. Now, from a halachic perspective, it's obviously problematic, because we don't believe in vicarious punishment, certainly administered by a beis din. Maybe God has maybe a different cheshbon, but certainly a beis din. So David decided, and presumably with divine guidance, that he had to temporarily abrogate the law of the Torah. And the line that the Gemara attributes to David is, "Mutav she'te'akir os achas min haTorah v'al yischal al shem shamayim mifarhesya." Better that one os should be uprooted from the Torah rather than God's name be desecrated. And the assumption was that people, in effect, it was a tremendous Kiddush Hashem, because people would walk by and they would see these people hanging and hanging beyond. It's also Lo Salin Nivla Soaleis. I don't know if the Gemara specifies it from there. So left their bodies hanging for months. And Ritzba Basaya, who was a descendant of Pelegesh Hashem, maybe protected them from the animals, but they left them hanging, which was also in violation of Torah law. So the Kiddush Hashem, the Gemara describes, is that people would walk by and ask, who are these people hanging? They would say that they were, members of the previous royal household who were killed because the king, previous king, had harmed, killed 7 foreigners. So people would say, wow, you know, if this is the way they, you know, treat the, you know, they demand the honor of the foreigners, you can imagine how they treat each other. And that would be a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. And therefore, David decided better to violate these particular, whatever the precept involved that they were violating. So Lieberman suggested, I think it's a little pshetel, so the response is a question. What do you mean, mutav shetei achar os achas min haTorah? It's a pasuk. It's mikra malay, whichever pasuk you want. So Lieberman suggests that perhaps this phrase was borrowed by the Medrash there, by the Gemara there, from another context. And he suggests that the context that perhaps it was originally relevant to, in which the literal reading of the statement made sense, was the principle of kino hakasav, that mutav shetei achar os achas min haTorah va'al yizkal l'shem shamayim b'farhesa. It's very clever, right? All the kina, it's kina kasav, is God's honor. You don't want to be speaking in a manner that's disrespectful towards God, and therefore you change one letter in the Torah. I don't remember if Lieberman makes it suggesting that kina kasav is like Tikkun Sofer, that Chazal changes as opposed to the original author, but I suspect that he is. It's not impossible, because Tikkun Sofer almost certainly seems to mean that. But I'm not convinced. It's a nice drush, but I think it's just a manner of speaking. I'm not sure that the two are connected. That doesn't necessarily shed light on what you think Kina Kasav is, although I think Kina Kasav means the original author, not a later change. Yes. So the answer is bigger and lesser. The answer is, you can, theoretically, we always say that every Aveir is a Chil Hashem. The question is, what is the magnitude and scope?
Right.
Well, the way Chazal understood, I don't remember whether it was on Lo Salin Nivlaso or whether it was on the Yisrael Sabanim. It might be that, I think certainly there are midrashim that suggest that the pasuk sounds like David made some choices. But it's even the pasuk, it's pretty clear that he has had a divine mandate. I think in some midrashim it may be that they passed him in front of the Urim and Thummim or something like that and chose the 7. So now, which of course in its own right suggests that, well, it wasn't violation of Torah anymore, there was a special abrogation by divine decree, you know, Horasha Lamidar Milsa, which you have. You have such a notion that Navi can uproot a, with the exception of Avodah Zarah, can uproot any specific mitzvah on a temporary basis. Yeah, sure. Eliyahu and Har HaKarmel was Shkutei Chutz, it's Chai Bekrisus. Elisha was Baal Tashchis. So certainly, but whether or not the Gemara is working with that particular view of how David selected them or not, again, I don't remember which Issa they were dealing with. But even in situations where you're not talking about divine sanctions, the whole notion, the Rambam's view, and I think the Baal HaMor also, on Yehori B'al Yavor, is that, you know, the assumption is that the death of a human being or of a Jew is a Chil Hashem. It's a Pagam and a Tzelem Elokim. So normally when you have a mitzvah of the Torah lined up against Sakanas Nefashos, so you say that it's a bigger Chil Hashem, you know, for the person to die, and therefore better that you violate the particular mitzvah in question. But by the Gimel Averis, for the Rambam, if a person is forced and he does the Avera, he hasn't violated the Avera, he's violated Chil Hashem. Because in those cases, the assumption is the Averis are so great that the Chil Hashem in violating one is greater than in a person losing his life. That's the assumption. That's sort of, it's a calculation that's made. So we don't make this calculation every day, you know. If you know any of that topic, Avera Lishma, you can see it goes a little bit down that path. But whatever, that's the topic in its own right. Yes.
Where is the story?
Yevamos, I think it's Ayin Tes. It's the sugya of what do they call them in Mishnah? They're not called Givonim. They're called Nesinim. Thank you. Yes. No, he just observes. He says La Dafka. His question is answered. He says La Dafka Osafas. But his question is obvious. I mean, he doesn't really give me an answer. He says, yeah. Which I think is correct, by the way. I think the Ritva is right. Meaning, it's very sharp, but I think it's drush. He didn't mean it as drush. I mean, I don't think he was laying much on the line for this one. I don't think he would have stated much on it. But yes, that is.
If you don't have Lieberman, how do we explain the second half of that phrase? Because the...
Shetei Achar, Aus Achas Menatora?
No, the other half.
She's called Shem Shemayim Parhesia.
But the opposite, because why is the opposite Chilul Hashem Parhesia? If you don't hand over the seven descendants of Shaul, why is that Chilul Hashem Parhesia?
So, okay, you know, I can start to give all sorts of answers for the Medrash, but you can't sort of ask the questions on that, and I don't want to answer them here. It's a fair question. I'm not standing behind the Medrash. I just mention that in this context because it's relevant. Yeah.
Part of the story
in Tanakh. Yeah, I'm sorry?
This whole story in Tanakh. I mean,
everything but the what's that?
Except for
according to Sukkot. What do you mean? Mutav Shish. In other words, the story that God was angry, the famine, he was told, David went to them, tried to appease him, they would only take seven, lives. David gave him, they were killed, hung out, Rishvathaya guarded them, eventually David buried them and said nice things to her because of the chesed she did. So Chazal pick up on that is the reason why the Chachamim would go there against the Nesina Mary into the cloud. Because David said that they're not, that the three traits of Bnei Avraham Avinu are Rachman and Baishanim Gom Lechasadim, and these people are not. Shmuel Beis Perek Chaf Aleph. Okay, probably in school you never get that far because you start the sefer and then by the end of the day you got into Perek Yud Ches, Yud Ches, whatever. Okay. Anyway, so that's Kinat Kosov and the Sifrei. There also is, I don't think we put in the video, you also have, no we don't, the Tikkuni Sofrim. You have really a Medrash Shmos Rabbah and Bereishis Rabbah where you have the term Tikkun Sofrim used. Now, it happens to be that the Vavasa Eino, which we saw here in Shmos Rabbah, is described as a Tikkun Sofrim in Shmos Rabbah, as a Tikkun Sofrim in Shmos Rabbah. Which could lead to the assumption that the fact Kinah Kosov and Tikkun Sofrim are one and the same thing. Now, of course, that doesn't tell you which it is. Does it mean that Tikkun Sofrim is really Kinah Kosov, or is Kinah Kosov really a Tikkun of the Sofrim? In other words, is it a real, is it a later change, or is it an original authorial formulation? The other one, which is a little more striking, but again, in itself, doesn't prove one way or the other, is we mentioned already, Abraham Odenu made the Fnei Hashem. And that's described in Bereishis Rabbah as a Tikkun Sofrim. Now, the problem with this, so on its own again, you don't know whether or not this means the Torah was originally given that way as a euphemism, or in fact whether it was changed later. Rashi, we read already on Parshas Vayera there, on that pasuk says, Echad mitikkuni sofrim shehafachu razal lichtokein, that Chachamim switched the writing around. And in case one is not convinced by how Rashi understood their Tikkun Sofrim, I mentioned also the passage in Eov. And Rashi's lashon there on Vayer Shiwes Eov, that comes after Eov's three friends finally kept quiet, and Elihu was ready to speak. So it says that he waited, and then he was angry about the three of them because they didn't answer Eov properly, and Vayer Shiwes Eov. And they turned him into a rasha. They accused him of wickedness, which is an issa d'oraisa, of onas dvarim. So, anyway, I don't know if that was Elihu's halacha cheshbon. I don't know if he was, but anyway, whatever it is, for us it's an issa d'oraisa to tell somebody that he's suffering because he did sin X and Y and Z. Okay, so Rashi writes, Vayarshiu es Eov. Was not that Eov was criticized by Elihu? He was angry because Al Tzadko Nafsho Me'Elokim, that he claimed himself to be more just than God. The others were criticized for because they didn't answer you properly by Yashiu Es Eov. So I could have read the pasuk Kipshuto. Now it changes. Rashi writes, I don't know what his source is. Ze'echad min haMikraos sheTiknu Sofrim Es Lashon HaKosov. That's the lashon that he uses. Shetiknu sofrim es lashon hakasav. Now, what do you think that means? Do you think that means what we like to use the term kinah kasav, or what we use the term tikkun sofrim? In terms of meaning, I don't care about what he's relating to. Is that an authorial change, or is that a later change by scribes? I think it's pretty clear it's a later change. There's no way of getting around this lashon Rashi. Now, of course, this one is less problematic because it's on Eov, it's not on the Torah. But he certainly is giving you an idea of what he means by Tikkun Sofrim. Now, listen to the continuation. So again, Ze'echem mena mikraos shetiknu sofrim es lashon akasav, vayashiu is klape hamakom b'shtikusam I mean, they incriminated God because they failed to answer Eo's charges of theodicy. So it should have said, Vayashiwas Hashem. But it wasn't going to say that. Elo Shekino HaKosov. Okay? Which is fascinating. And then he goes on to quote other examples that we find in the Sefer Bamidbar, which is striking for two reasons. Firstly, it's clear, it's pretty clear how he understood what happened in Eov. And it also seems to shed light, although I won't go to the math for this, how he also understood Kina Kosov, that Kina Kosov is not an original euphemism, it's a later change. Now, you can't really prove that, you could just be pointing out that there are similarities. But notice on the Eov one itself, he says, Ela Shekina HaKosov. After saying, Ze'echad min ha-mikros, she'tiknu sofim es lashon ha-kosov. So it does seem that he understood Kina HaKosov as a later change. Okay, but certainly in the context of Eov, it's clear and it's pretty explicit in his in the one case in the Torah. Whether Rashi really held for all the other Kina HaKosovs, that far, we can't be, that much we can't be entirely sure. You have to make sure also that Rashi on Eov is really Rashi. I think it is, but you have to check that out. If it's not, then somebody else wrote this. Okay, but Rashi and the Torah is still clear, at least on that Tikkun Sofer. Again, Rashi and the Torah doesn't mention Kina Kasav. He just says, Zechad mit Tikkun Sofrim, Shafachu Razalach Tokim, along those lines. Yes? Yeah, well, Rishonim, not as, I don't know if, how much you get it in Rishonim, you certainly get it among sort of Maskil Shachronim, that their lines are drawn between Torah and the rest. So one might have expected such a distinction, and clearly in the Rambam Zikrei Emunah there's going to be a clear distinction, but Rashi doesn't seem to be drawing that distinction. The Kina Kosov, by the way, in the Sifrei also don't draw that distinction, but it wouldn't be so problematic. It's not troubling if we assume that means original author, right? So just as, you know, Yeshayahu might have decided to write it, or wherever it was, Zechariah decided to write it one way for euphemism, so too Moshe Rabbeinu was told to write it a certain way because of euphemism. When Rashi seems to blur the line, then we know what he holds by Tikkun Sofrim. That's pretty clear. Okay.
Fine. Why would Rashi and
Eov not be Rashi? We don't have Rashi in all the books of Tanakh, and I'm not saying, I know nothing to say that it's not. But, you know, I mean, we know Rashi and Chumash, you know, aside from the fact that there's material introduced, but in principle, Rashi and Chumash is Rashi in most of Tanakh. But there are certain Sfarim, I'm not sure, that I think they have questions whether it's really from Rashi or somebody else's parish. Okay. Next topic is the next source in the meter, number 19, the Ksav. The script of our Torah. Anybody here learn second parish Sanhedrin? Or CDs? What script was the Torah originally written in? Aaron? What's that? Ksav Ivri. What is Ksav Ivri? They call it Paleo Hebrew or the Samaritan script. If you want to know what Paleo Hebrew looks like, look at page 24. These are different letters of the alphabet based upon inscriptions. Paleo Hebrew. Ksav Ivri, when we use the term in Hebrew.
Which one is Ksav?
The right side. So they tell you the various inscriptions that they come from. Now the reason why certain letters are missing is because those letters were probably not found in the particular inscription. Okay. Anyway, as you can see, we're going to see there are three shitas. Yes. So when we talk about Ksav Ivri, he mentioned one. I didn't mean to suggest that's the only opinion of the Gemara, but Ksav Ivri. Is what you see on the right side. Now, why is Ksav Ivri theory used? What's its advantage over Ksav Ashuri, which is the left side? The advantage of Ksav Ivri over Ksav Ashuri is it's easier to write on stone. Now, it happens to be, what's that? Ksav Ivri is easy to write on stone. Yeah. Why? Because most of the letters tend to be more wedge-like. You could also probably write it better in cuneiform. The earlier ones in particular are very heavily straight lines. Not all, but almost all. And it's certainly going to be easier in writing and brick, you know, on mud tablets. There you can imagine trying to drag around in a circle. It's much easier to make wedges, like cuneiform is made. Now, it happens to be that all the inscriptions from the Bais Rishon period are in Ksav Ivri, which would, in fact, at least if you accepted the data at face value, would, in fact, match with one of the shitas in the Gemara. Okay, so let's take a look at the Gemara. However, I mentioned the point before that the fact that Paleo-Hebrew may be easier to write in certain contexts, and it may be that those are the only materials that we have preserved, which is the only reason why we see Ksav Ivri. The truth be told, when you look in the Qumran scrolls, everything but in some scrolls the Shem Hashem is written in Ksav Ashuri. I don't know if there are any documents that are really written Ksav Ivri. The Shem Hashem was sometimes written that way. They already...
Is that, that's my
scene. Yes, I understand. So listen to what I was going to say for a moment. The fact is, in Bayit Sheni, except for the Samaritans, already Ksav Ashuri is the dominant form of writing. The only reason we can demonstrate that is because we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, which survived by a freak accident of history. Right? Were it not for the unusual conditions in which they were kept, we would not have them. It's very rare to find papyri, or in this case, parchment finds from the Bayit Sheni period, because the nature of the material is such, its organic nature, makes it far less likely to survive. And therefore, if there was Ksav Ashuri being used, and if it were used more likely on things such as parchment or other softer materials in the Bayit Rishon period, we would not necessarily know that from the... We would not expect to find that in the archaeological record, because the archaeological record is not likely to exist. If you look how little we have from Bayit Sheni, and late Bayit Sheni, it's going to be a Kal v'chomer v'min Oshel Kal v'chomer to Bayit Rishon. Okay. Yes? Because on where, what are these inscriptions? Sarcophagi, stela, which is stone monuments usually, and the like. If you just look at the examples there, he has the Achiram sarcophagus, that's stone probably. I don't know what the Gezer calendar is. The Mesha inscription, okay, which, if I get my act together for next week, by the way, I'm going to do what I really wanted to do, which is I will send you a couple of questions. You might view it almost not quite as a response paper, but I want to send you a text or two, or send you Mari Malcolm for the text or two. I'm thinking particularly about the Mesha inscription. Any of you know what the Mesha inscription is? You'll find interesting in a particular passage in Malachim. I want you to respond. I want you to react to it. I think it will make much more interesting discussion in the class. So watch your YU emails. If you don't use your email, YU email, your YU email is your main account, make sure you forward it, because I will send it out on the, I have a way to send it out to the class email list. So I'll send you what I want you to look at and some questions to respond to in writing. I will probably collect them. I'm probably only going to collect them to see that you did them. I'm not going to grade it. But that's your preparation for class, and it will make for a more lively class. It'll be interesting. Yes. It's not a punishment or an anger. I think it will make for a better educational experience. It won't be a long response. You're talking about writing, maybe 2-3 paragraphs, but I want you to read it and think about it. Yeah.
The assumption that there was
Well, as I mentioned, in Qumran, for example, the Shemos Hashemah being written in what they probably perceive as the older script, out of respect for them, it's not inconceivable that two scripts are being used. Let me ask you a question today. Do we use one script or two scripts? Three. I can think of immediately three that we use regularly, right? Printers use two scripts, regular block and Rashi. Said in our writing, we use what we would call script. Right? So it's not inconceivable. I actually marvel, and I don't know how many people here, any of you who didn't start, didn't have a yeshiva education at a young age, but I marvel at how almost all the kids who are trained, I don't think it's just me, and I know it's not just me, how you can read, go back and forth between scripts so naturally. It's not even your native tongue for most people, and you don't even think about it. You just go back, if you get used to the script, it's like you don't even think twice about it. Now, I will tell you, when you learn to read a language that has a different script, like Greek, it takes you a good long while. You can get okay at it, but it's not like reading the script in English. So I always marvel at that. But it's not inconceivable that multiple scripts are going at the same time. Not at all. I'm not saying that we don't have evidence that they were, at least in the Bais Rishon period, but that's, you know, in Lo Ra'isi Ein Araya. I mean, that's really the print. I mean, that's one of the problems with archaeology, and it shouldn't be overstated, but nonetheless, it's a problem, is that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. The classic line goes, not mine. Yes?
Do you know what was written on the stones in the Bais Rishon period?
What was written on the stones in the Bais Rishon period? I don't know offhand. I'm just looking at what he has here. He has a Bar Kokhba letter, okay, another letter, signatures of witnesses, Aramaic B, signatures of witnesses. I don't know what the Dura Europas fragment is. The tomb inscription. So you do have one thing, the last two columns apparently came from the tomb. However, although that's late. Yeah, no. I mean, it's already late. That's very late. So maybe that's already 3rd century. Maybe at that point the old script is no longer around. They don't know, they don't use it anymore. Once you don't use it, you have no choice but to use the other script, right? But the ones that are early are all on. I don't know what the first one is. The exit, I don't know what Exodus fragment is, unless that's so I can't comment on it. Although but the Bar Kokhba letter and the other letter and the signatures in Aramaic beat are all going to be, and the signatures are all going to be parchment or papyri. Okay. Fine. So what are the three sheet does from the Gemara in Sanhedrin? We have belaboring the point. So let's read the Gemara. Ezra, read. Page 19. Amar Mazutra.
Amar Mazutra.
Okay, this is a very, very bizarre Gemara. Forget the Ksav part. The Ksav part, maybe you could swallow. I mean, you have to explain, if you believe that the Torah was given in Ksav Ashuri, and then we write in Ksav Ashuri, so the truth is, when you initially start out thinking, it blows your mind and you say, what kind of heresy is this? When you stop and think, you could argue as follows. Perhaps the din is the Torah has to be written in Hebrew script, but if Hebrew script changes, then you can write the Sefer Torah in whatever the Hebrew script is. You know, the Tzuras Ostios aren't necessarily, I'm not saying they aren't, but they aren't necessarily Misina. I mean, obviously, whoever the Tzuras Marzut or Marukba didn't hold that they were. In other words, the din is whatever the Hebrew script is, that's what you write in. That's one thing. But Lashon Arami and Lashon HaKodesh? It's crazy. Yeah. No, that's rejected. That's the position in the end that it never changed. It always was an Ashur. So that's at the end of the Gemara. But I should also comment, is it Mar Zutra or Mar Ukva? The answer is, it's almost certainly Mar Ukva, who was second generation, Bava Rochista appears to be responding to him, as opposed to Mar Zutra, who was sixth generation. Okay? Yes? Okay, so even if you're talking about between Lashon Arami and Lashon HaKodesh, right? I'll even putting that problem aside, assume for the moment that look, there are shitos in the Mishnah, and the Gemara raises that issue is raised, but the Gemara talks about writing Sfarim and Shara Lashona. So the Gemara certainly, the Mishnah postulates that you can write Sifrei Nah, maybe not Torah, I don't remember. It's in the Mishnah Megillah, around Daf Tes. You can write Sfarim, Sifrei Nah, in Greek. So the Gemara, I believe, does talk about the problem of certain words they didn't know what they meant, in like anishtavan or things like that. But bottom line is that does not seem to have been a sufficient deterrent to actually have Sfarim in another language with the Kedusha Sifrei Tanakh, just written in a different language. So I'll be mocha on that problem for the moment. But the notion that you could change the language of the writing in the Torah, you know, Mikra Shekseva Targum, Targum Shekseva Mikra. It's nice that they chose for themselves Lashon Ivri and Lashon HaKodesh and Ksav Ashuri. Fine. So I can swallow his maskana, but it's just mind-boggling. Okay.
You don't know what means they chose, I think.
They selected, yeah, that's what the words mean. It's not clear who did the Birur. Who was Borer? That's not Gola. I don't know. Okay, then Amar Chista. So the word says Man Had Yotos. Kutoi. Who are the Kutoi? The Kutim. Who are the Kutim? Well, we don't really know exactly, but the term Chazal used, we're not really sure of their origins, but Chazal used the term Kutim to refer to the Samaritans of their day. Guess what script the Samaritans use? Anyone want to take a wild guess? The Paleo-Hebrew script. That's what the Samaritans use. I may use that Arayom Azeh. So when the Gemara said, Kutai, we know what Tzav Ivri is now. Tzav Ivri is the Paleo-Hebrew. Tzav Ashuri is called such. Why? Probably because they brought it back from Ashur. It happens to be that Aramaic was the lingua franca, if that's the term, for the Babylonian Empire, and then the Persian Empire that stayed, I guess, until the Hellenistic influences, until the Greek invasion, Alexander's invasion. At least Aramaic for hundreds of years was the royal language. It was the official language of the ancient Near East, of the various kingdoms. You see a picture of that. I think, I don't know if this is the earliest stages, but in the story of Chizkia and Sancheirev, when Sancheirev is taunting, so Chizkia's servants ask them to speak Aramit and not to speak Ivrit, because the people on the walls would understand. And of course, to which Sancheirev retorts, "I didn't come to speak to you. I came to let them know, because they're the ones who are going to be eating their whatever, you know, when when I lay siege on the city." What's that? I euphemized as well. So you see then already that Aramaic was the official royal language for communications and things like that. They speak about a different dialect, in fact, or a different usage, royal Aramaic versus, let's say, biblical Aramaic and later Aramaic. But it's not surprising to see Aramaic should have been one of the choices, but the notion that you could even think about changing is wild. Okay, so what is Tzav Ivris? Libunaa. What does Rashi write? Is this correct? No, but Rashi had no way of knowing, right? Rashi probably never saw Paleo Hebrew script in his life. This is just the benefits of archaeology, of standing in effect on the giant, on the shoulders of giants. There's no way Rashi could have known what Ksav Libunaa is. And the Rishonim, basically the Rishonim, are in a sense forced to guess. And if it weren't for the fact that certainly Rashi, you know, wouldn't be surprised, it wouldn't shock me. Again, who would have been the only Rishonim who possibly really could have known what this was? The only Rishonim who possibly could have recognized what this was would have been people who came in contact with the Samaritans, who are very few today, but were not very many in the Middle Ages either. Right, the Rambam's favorite heretics were Karaites, but they didn't use the same script as we do. The only way that Rishonim could even possibly have known what Ksav Libunaa was, what the Kuti script was, is they had come in contact with Samaritans, which they didn't. Certainly Rashi didn't, and therefore he's conjecturing as to what it is. But in fact, I think it's pretty clear from the fact that it's identified by Rechista as the Kutai Hedyotos, that we're talking about the Paleo Hebrew, the Samaritan script. I believe they use the regular script that we use. Let's put it this way. I studied the Bayesh, my formal training is more in the Bayesheni period, but I never heard of the Karaites using anything but the script that we do. So you can check. But it's clear from what the Gemara meant anyway, in terms of Lashon Hedyotos, if Rechista is correct, and we'll assume that he is, Hedyotos are Kutoi, then we're talking about the Paleo Hebrew script. Okay. Right, but written in a different way. Yeah. He says, Osios Gedolos, Kenosim Shkosim, Kenosim Azizos. He may mean that people used to write all sorts of things in the backs of Mizuzah. The Rambam goes nuts about this practice in Hilchos Mizuzah. He flies off the handle that people wrote angels and things like that on the back and Shemos. We held that it was like Kfira. What's that? Very, very minimal. Probably better not to, but don't tell the. But you know, the Sofer aren't going to listen to you anyway. So, if the Rambam had his druthers, we wouldn't write even that. So, I'm sure he didn't have it on his mezuzahs. Anyway, so that's one shita. Now they quote a brisa. Tanya, Rabbi Yosei Omer. Kidmo Moshe, if it had been written with a yod, then that lo might have been appropriate, but it would be a strange lashon. But Amalei Kidmo Moshe. Mahaliyah. Don't ask me what this means. I have absolutely no idea. I take it to mean Chazal, what Chazal meant to say is that Ezra played a pivotal role in the development of Torah as a Moshe Rabbeinu. Ezra with his, I'm not a Rav Tzadok person, I don't know much about it, but Dr. Elman can tell you more, but Rav Tzadok, I've heard him say, you know, viewed that the Bayis Rishon was a period of Nebuah and the Bayis Sheni was a Tkuf of Torah. For the Rambam Zeru Torah Shabbat Peh, the Bayis Sheni witnesses, at least as we have the evidence, you can't prove what was in Bayis Rishon, the great explosion of Torah Shabbat Peh, the development of Torah Shabbat Peh. So one, in a sense, might find the roots of that with Ezra, and the roots of Torah, the roots of Torah Shabbat Peh, but the trunk of Torah Shabbat Peh and all of Torah Shabbat Peh with Moshe Rabbeinu. So that may be what the dimin is being made, but it's a strange statement. Yeah. Well, that's correct. Aside from Takanas of Ezra, anything that's Rabbanon, you can assume for the most part originates in the Bayis Sheni period, which follows Ezra. I mean, it's not necessarily from Ezra.
But...
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
the Gemara. Well, actually, according to the Gemara, and again, it's hard to know whether you take the Gemara historically. It originates in the Midbar. Ezra added on to that. So I'm not gonna.
The
system we have today did not originate with Ezra. The system we have today originates probably late Bayis Sheni, early post-Korban period. In fact, it wasn't set. In Eretz Yisrael, they started by the triennial cycle. Right? You've got to give it to the other sects who decided they wanted to do the triennial cycle also. Of course, what they didn't figure out was that when they used to read the triennial cycle, they used to read a third of Parshas Bereishis this week, or approximately, and then a third next week, and a third the following week. The way those who do it today, is conservative or reform movement, I don't know, is they read one third of Parshas Bereishis this week, one third of Parshas Noach next week, one third of Parshas Lech Lecha, and next year they read the second third and the following the third third. Okay. Because you know, probably in their schools they can't coordinate. It's in the schools they're teaching them Parshas HaShavua, so following the standard cycle. Anyway, so our Kriyas HaTorah system is, you know, certainly in flux in the period of Chazal, and it's only, you know, it doesn't achieve full solid, even in the medieval period. Professor Bernstein reminded me recently, if you look in Parshas Mishpatim, there used to be two Parshias in it. They usually read joint, but they sometimes separated. In Kesef Tal Vesami, and if you don't believe me, go open the Minchas, go open the Sefer Achinuch, and he starts each parsha and mentions, and you'll see there's a new parsha, say Parshas in Kesef. You'll see. So it may have been this actually, the Taka is the year they would split it. They would split it for a certain reason, to make sure that the Mitzorah came out before Pesach. It's going to be a very unusual year. This year we read Achrimos before Pesach, which virtually never happened. It hasn't happened in 20 years. Anyway, so normally it's Tzav before Pesach in a non-leap year and Mitzorah in a leap year, but not this year. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so... No, I think the whole point is that we like to read continuously. So if you want to finish the Torah over 3 years, that's fine. If you want to finish the Torah over 1 year, that's fine. And generally speaking, well, that might happen occasionally by accident. That's not the norm. So anyway, all right. So moving on. I'm not saying that so much as attack. I just find it humorous. Someone said they wanted, they really felt they need to do the triennial cycle because of their shul, whatever, so do the triennial cycle. Not the way it's done. But okay. Anyway, so one opinion is, Tanya Rabbi Yose Omer. We're in the middle of that. Okay. The Afalpi, go to the bottom line already. The Afalpi
should listen to Torah al Yodo, Mishkan al Yodo.
Hanishtavan Kasuv Aramis Surgan Aramis. This is the introduction that the unfortunate Ezra that starts with Aramaic. It had to do with an epistle, a letter that was sent either to the king of Persia or from the king of Persia to them. Kasuv Aramis Surgan Aramis. And I can't tell you what that means, Bottom line is that Darshan Ksav HaNishtavan is Ksav Shnishtana. Okay. Pshat is not that way, but that's the way they're reading it. Okay, fine. Uksiv. Upshar Lahodal Lamalka. So it's not clear what he's based in. Again, it's probably this is possible from Daniel, that the writing couldn't be read. Okay, so anyway, bottom line is Uksiv, the Chasavis Mishnei. Go ahead. And the way I think this should be read, I never used to realize or see it this way, it means that a ksav is roi l'shtanos, it means that a script doesn't have to be fixed. Within a script, you have to write the script properly, but if the script changes, so the ksav is roi l'shtanos. Okay, that's one opinion. Then find last one. Lama Nikra
Ashur Shahala Yvan Ashur.
Yeah, came back with them from Ashur. Fine. Tanya Rebbe Omer. Okay, so Rebbe says, no, this was the original Ksav, it was changed to Ksav Ivri, then it was changed back to Ksav Ashuri. Now, it's a little, the timing is a little bit unclear. Unclear, but it would seem, according to Rebbe, that there was a historical period in which it was written as Ksav Ivri, perhaps. Now, if that's the case, you have the same theological problem that you do with the first Shita in terms of changing things. Okay, but the last Shita is... It's not clear, but the Yushalmi has, if you look at the Yushalmi, they use that expression to refer to Ksav Ivri. Yushalmi is where? I think it reads backwards. Amar Levi Manda Amar Lerat Nitna Torah Ayin Masanisim Manda Amar Ashuri Nitna Torah Samach Maisanisim. So you know the Medrash that the Memon of Samach Shabluchos Bnei Sayyum Din. So here the Yushalmi has Samach. Samach, you understand, is written as a round circle. Look in the Ksav Ivri chart for a moment. Look under the Samach. Do you think there's anything miraculous about a Samach? Survey says no. Nothing miraculous about a samach. That would stand up even if you ran it through all the way. What does have a circle that would fall out? The middle part would have fallen out if you didn't have an ace? The ayin. Okay? So it's clear what ra'at is. Right? It's the same as ksav ashuri. You know, I don't know, I have no idea what the etymology of the term is. You know, the only thing I could think of is if it's a confusion of da'at, could mean theoretically to engrave, to stick in, or something like that. But I don't know. Anyway, so that's what Rebbe says. Lama nekra shema and lama nekra shema ashuris. Shema usheres ksav. It's beautiful ksav. Okay, it definitely is prettier than the ksav ivri, in my opinion. Okay, but whatever. Finally, they quote one last shita.
Amudai.
Vaveho amudim. Ma amudim lo nishtanu, just as the amudim never changed. Now the amudim here are the pillars of the courtyard around the Mishkan. But does anybody know what the vaveho amudim svarim are? Excellent. Every column starts with a vav, which is not so hard in one sense because it's a very common beginning, except for five columns technically. Six columns by tradition are supposed to start with six specific letters, because Shemo. You will see that Bereishis is the obvious one, that has no choice. The Yud is Yehuda Atal Yoducha Achecha. The Hey is Habayim Achreihem Bayam, right above the Shira, Shiras Hayam. The Shin, there are at least two different versions. Someone sent me this question recently. There are two versions of the Shin at least. One is Shmar Lucha and Kisisa, and the other one is Shnei Sirei Zim and Achrei Mos. And then the Mem, is Matovu Alecha Yaakov, and the Vav, which everything is a Vav, but if you didn't have a Vav Ayamud in the Sefer, so any letter could start, except for this one right before Shiras Hazinu, V'o'idah Bames HaShemayim HaSaretz. So this is, by the way, a Masoretic Simon. Okay? Yeah.
Why?
Why are you six? I have no clue. I can't tell you. No, you find this problem. I mean, if some scribal practice, there's probably a reason. I don't know what it is. The base, I can tell you the reason for it. Okay? I can even surmise as to why the Hey of Haba'im and the Vav of Va'ida, because since they probably wanted the Shira written in a certain position on the thing, because they're also in the Tzurus HaShira, so that's probably why they already became a fixed practice. In other words, you would tell the scribes, make sure that you wind up the Hey of Haba'im Achraim Ba'im starting the column, and then you'll have no problem with the Shira. I have no idea why the Yudav Yehuda Hechachacha, the Mem of Matov Alach, and it's a nice text, it's a beautiful passage, Matov, it's nice to have on top, but that's not really enough of a reason. Matov certainly doesn't, and neither does Shnei Sireizim or Shmar Lecha. Yehuda, maybe, but it's still not close enough. There's still more than a column to go. So I don't know why, but it is a simon from Bali Masorah. If you look back in the original tikkun that was printed, that I still have, you know, when I was a kid, that still was sort of the only tikkun. You know, Jewish printing, all these printing with glitter and everything else, some of which are not worth more than the original editions, is a fairly recent phenomenon. When I was a kid, you had sort of the standard tikkun lakorim, you know, like a blue with my night, what's worn out, but originally it was gold. They still sell it, probably. That's the original tikkun. So there, it's actually very nice. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not as easy to use as some of the tikkunim, but he left a lot of the little notes on the bottom. They're minor masoretic notes. One of the very useful things he has is whenever you have a kamatz, you often see a kamatz bezayin kuf, which means bezakev katan. When you have pausal forms on things that are not a snachta or so pasuk, right? Normally kesef turns to kasef, it's called a pausal form. When you get a pause, the accent sometimes shifts there, or the vowel lengthens, yishmeru becomes yishmoru. So that sometimes happens in the middle of a pasuk on major pause in prop, which are not a snachta so pasuk. The common, only common one being zakev katan. So you'll see on the bottom, he still prints kamatz bezah. And he also, I believe, has the siman b'kashemo in the various places that it occurs. You can probably find the Mincha Shai also in the back. You should know the Mincha Shai. Well, I have to save some time from Masoretic issues. Yeah.
What was that thing you wanted to point out on the text of the Ayin?
The Yerushalmi says that if you hold that the Torah was given in Ra'at, which means some other tzav, then the Nes in the Luchos was not the Samach, it was the Ayin. And indeed, what does the ayin look like in Ksav Ivri? You understand why the Samach Shemeluchos were Om the Menes?
The Samach, I understand.
Right. So if you look at the ayin in Ksav Ivri, same thing. It's a circle. That's ayin. Look on top. You see where it says Samach?
Yeah.
Look down. Do you see anything there that couldn't stand under ordinary circumstances? That would not require a nace. If the luchos were engraven all the way through, okay, meaning the letters were hollowed out, you would have no problem with the samach.
It looks, I mean, I'm something like that.
That's not a problem. But the ayin, the left of it,
looks like that.
Exact same problem with the samach. What's that? Oh, okay, yes. So the right side. Okay. Anyway, so from the historical record, the evidence would tilt slightly in favor of saying Ksav Ivri was the original Ksav until Ezra's time. But again, it's an argument from silence. I don't have a particular strong feeling. I would argue today, though, that if you were to write a Sefer Torah, Ksav Ivri would be possible. Okay, you have to write a Sefer Torah, Ksav Ashuri. All right. Now, interestingly enough, it could. There's a very interesting Radak in Divrei Hayamim. And the Radak writes, it's right after this material, the Radak writes that in Breishis it's called Kitim V'Dodanim, in Divrei Hayamim it's called V'Rodanim. So he suggests, if you look at the Radak printed on the right side of page 25, Shnei Dalsin, V'Divrei Hayamim V'Rodanim, V'Reish, that's the Radak from Breishis, obviously. V'Reish Rishonim, V'Shem Kasav Nutam Achilufim, V'Adal V'Reish Krovim V'Ksav, V'Fikach Toh Haron V'Ksav Hashem HaRishonah, Yeshikar B'Dalf, Yeshikar B'Reish. Moshe Rabbeinu Kro Bedalas Lefi She Va'asa Ruach HaKodesh Ve'ezra Kasa Bereish Lodiya Ki Heim Baksuv Meshe Yesh Kro Bedal Ve'yesh Bereish. So people used to read, it was a hard thing to read. Moshe Rabbeinu wrote it the way he was told. Ezra chose to preserve the other one when he wrote Rodanim. Very nice. It's interesting that the Dal and the Resh, would this hold true if it were Ksav Ivri? So if you look in Ksav Ivri, in the Dal and the Resh, at an earlier stage not as much, at a later stage the Dal and the Resh, when you start already by, go to line 7, so you can see the similarities somewhat, starting to begin. If you look at line 8, getting closer, you look at line 9, you can't tell the difference very easily between a dalet and a resh. Same thing else true for 10 and 11. 11 although starts to look a little bit more like our ksav, even though it's still considered Paleo-Hebrew. And 12, what about the 12 also? Very similar, 12 and 13. So the fact that the dalet and the resh swap, in fact, could take place whether or not the Torah was given in ksav Ivri or ksav Ashur. Okay. Ezra didn't change when he wrote Divrei Hayamim. When he repeated the genealogies, he wrote it with the alternative pronunciation, as Radak said, Lodiya Shehim Abaksuvim, that it was an alternative version. Almost like, what does this remind you of? The Abar Ben Elon Krayev Siv. Okay. Not exactly the same, but similar. Yeah, stop.
I'm just curious. According to the Yerushalmi, that the island is in only the name. So theoretically, I mean, the head would also be the dollar.
So I can't really tell you why. No, it may have been by that when Yerushalmi was written, that at that point the ksav was as such. Obviously, they're looking at their own ksav in this medrash. They're looking at their own ksav and saying which of these letters required nes. That's all. So but that tells you more about the ksav they had than about the nes itself. Okay. All right. Now, the last piece that I want to focus on, there's some stuff that I don't read, but I'll talk about in the Masoretic issues, is the Gemara Nedarim about the Kunei Sofrim and the Iturei Sofrim, is Masoretic issues. There was an article that you were supposed to have read by Professor Dotan in the Encyclopedia Judaica. It's a very useful article. It can be a little dry at times. Did you see the article? Yeah. So, I always like to say, I proudly announced that I'm a little bit of a weird fellow and I actually enjoy reading the Masoretic notes. What's that? Oh, I saw. There is Encyclopedia Judaica online anyway, so you can get it from there. Me online in the library. So, what are Masoretic notes? Okay, Masoretic, what are Masoretic notes? Does anyone, any computer science majors here? I do this every semester, I never get a computer science major. I don't know what it is. Okay. Maybe there aren't so many computer science majors around. Maybe you haven't chosen the major yet. Anybody thinking about being a computer science major? No, that's not. So I always like to refer to what we call a parity check. You got a lot of zeros and ones coming through a wire. And static, I know, so you guys don't think that we use phone wires anymore, right? Because you think we use, you know, fiber optics and cable and so on. But okay, once upon a time when we used modems a little more often than you guys do. So you send data through a modem and you got zeros and ones and you get electrical interference. And that could, of course, create problems. Your zero might turn into a one. Your one might get down to a zero. So one of the ways that you make sure that there are no errors is, let's say you send 8 bits of one or zero and then you count how many ones and zeros there are, whether it's an odd or an even number. And then you send what's called the parity bit. If there were an odd number of bits, if there were odd number of ones in your sequence, and let's say your 8 bits, so then you send a 1 down. If there were an even number, you send a 0 down. Now, what does that mean? It means that if an error crept into one of your items that you sent, this parity check, as it was called, would help catch the error and you can know to resend the information. Of course, if 2 of them get messed up and reversed, it's not going to help you. Okay, there's nothing you can do about that. I mean, it's an unlikely occurrence that parity errors happen. You guys don't even know once upon a time. This is before some of you were born. And the earliest IBM PCs, you would get sometimes called a parity error and the computer would just lock up like that. worse than death by Microsoft. Okay, and the blue screen, the screen of blue death, whatever it is. So, so anyway, but it was a very rare occurrence, a very, very rare occurrence. So, by having a parity bit, that basically protects you. That is what the Bali Masorah did. Sounds a little strange, right? The Bali Masorah, you know, were computer science majors before the days of computers. What the Bali Masorah do is they counted letters and they counted words. And they noticed odd things about them. And they made lists. They were strange dudes by most of your standards. I find it to be fascinating. They went and they counted these things. They went and they counted these things and they made notes. And this way, if something happens, you're not sure about whether a spelling of a particular word is supposed to be male v'chaser. Well, and you know that the Bali Masorah have a note that says the word appears seven times chaser, and otherwise assumption is always male otherwise, and you already have seven cases about which you are definitive that they are chaser, and then you know that this case that you are suffering on is in fact the normal male form. That's what they did basically. They created lists, and they made these notes in the margins. There are different kinds. That's the goal of the Bali Masorah, to preserve the text. And by the way, they did a very good job. They don't need me to say so, but they did. Now, what kind of Masoretic issues that we speak about are preserved in the original text, the original consonantal text? Consonant means no vowels, no markings, just the consonant, or pretty much no markings. What were preserved in the original written text in the Bayesheni period? Four things. One are psuchos and stumos, the parshios, and their shapes. Two, with the dots. There's a controversial passage, controversial because some people, including a gadol shagon mentioned, didn't like the passage and wanted to claim it was just an error, but in fact our manuscript witnesses back it up. There's a passage in Maseches Sofrim that speaks about Ezra putting dots on the letters and why he's doing it. So you have, regardless of who put the dots on the letters, who's responsible, whether it's Mesinai, whether it was Ezra, so you have dots on letters that appear in the text itself. Nekudas don't, but they are nekudas, but vowels don't, but nekudas do, the dots on top of the word. What word has dots on top of it? Let's see how good you guys are. What's that? Lanu Levanei, that's probably the most famous one. What else? By Asa, by Yisha Kehu, by Aaron, I think Moshe Aharon in one of the countings. There's another one that you're missing. What is that one?
By the
I'm sorry? No, I don't think so. Yishpot Hashem Beini Uveinach, I believe, has a dot on top of it. There are a few more. There are not so many. But anyway, so you have these dots. You also have the Nun Hafucha, which was not necessarily originally a Nun. It was some type of a marking. And our not only Rishonim don't even call it a Nun Hafucha, it's a modern term for it. It looks a little like an upside down, an inverted Nun, but not entirely clear. Does anyone know the inverted Nun, which is not? No, that's where they are. There are two Nuns that seem to mark off a separate section. Does anyone know the inverted Nun that's not? I think Rashi, at the end of Parshas Noach, says, Vayamas Terach B'Charon, that is a Nun Hafucha, because until then it was Charon Ach Ba'olam. Not our Sfarim, but that's what Rashi writes there. You also have, finally, other strange letters. My favorite example is the Vav of the Vav Ketia. Anyone know where the Vav Ketia is? You have big letters and small letters. Those certainly don't possible a Sefer Torah. They're not bigger, they're not small. And you know where the cut Vav is, the Vav Ketia? Parshas Pinchas, the word Shalom. And you need to say in Lois Brisi Shalom. It's a question what Vav Ketia means exactly. Some say you just make the leg of the Vav a little shorter. In which case, cutting the Vav, which is what many of our Sfarim have, passes it. I remember once actually when I was growing up, there was a Sefer Torah, a new Sefer Torah, and they put the Sefer Torah back after the Vav wasn't cut. I know, we understand that it was definitely wrong. They definitely should not have put the Sefer Torah back. They did subsequently cut the Vav. Nearly, even though it is not the practice, that one would be better adopting other shitas in Vav Ketia, like making the Vav's leg a little shorter, but still clearly a Vav. Because if you don't have a Vav Ketia, the Pasha has no reason to pass the Sefer Torah. But if you get the wrong meaning of Vav Ketia, Vav Ketia didn't mean a Vav whose leg was cut, and you cut it high enough, then you have a Pasha of Vav. So anyway, this Vav Ketia, it's not clear what it was supposed to be. What's supposed to be done, but you have these funny letters. These are the only things that are preserved in the text itself until you get the written codices of the Bali Masora. They pronounce things with vowels, make no mistake. The Bali Masora did not invent vowels for the Hebrew language. You can't have a language, generally speaking, without vowels. But the signs for the vowels and the notion that they were written in the text is a later invention of the Bali Masora. Yes, Jared?
Are they also in the one in
I'm sorry? Yeah. Oh yes, they're also in Tehillim, yeah. There are some in Kuf Zayin.
Yeah.
So I said you have those big letters, they're not Ma'ake, but you may have those already, yeah. You may have this. We have a bunch of those. You probably have a number of cases where Rashi or others comment about big or small letters and three actually don't have big or small. Yeah. But as long as it has the Tzuras Os, it's not going to be a problem. I'm sure they give all sorts of reasons. I mean, I can imagine why you put it. I think the Beis Abracious is big. That's a dramatic thing. That's the beginning of the Torah, right? You know, like you ever see in printed books? You have the first letter, it gets bigger. It makes sense. Don't you laugh at you. I said this in Shir. It was my own Ha'ara, but it was built on what somebody else said. You know why it's probably Arboim Chaser Achas and not Shlosh HaMetesha? Think about Roman numerals. That's the way they counted. How do you say 10? You're laughing. I'm telling you. And as I said, the greatest. You'll be quiet. What was the greatest invention of the first millennium? The most significant technological invention of the first millennium?
Zero.
Good. Somebody knows something. The zero. Some of you are wondering what that means. I'm not going to explain that. But the zero was probably the most, maybe perhaps the most important invention of the last 2,000 years in technology. Some of you are scratching your heads. Zero. Yeah. The Romans had no. There's no zero in Roman numerals. Correct, but even after Arabic and writing, it probably invented the zero wasn't invented probably through the 8th or 9th century or something like that. And that was a gewaltig chap, even though you can't understand why it's a gewaltig chap because it's obvious too. Anyway, so. What's that? You can, but the way you write. 40, I mean, technically, the way 40 is written, but it would have been awkward to do this. The fact, though, how do you write 49 in Roman numerals? IL. Is L 50? I don't remember. Whatever it is. Right? It's 50 minus 1. That's how you count, unless you count persons, and then you count closer to the round number. So it would, to say Hamishim Chasar Achas, it would have been awkward, but this is the way people count it, you can see.
It also in Reiner Sassi, it also talks about, it doesn't say the full number, it'll say like 5 minus a third. You know
what I mean? The numeric system reflects a way of thinking. Yeah, that's the way people thought numbers. But anyway. So the same thing. All right. So what was something that prompted that? Hey, you laughed. What did I say? I never remember why I brought this in.
Large letters.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm saying. I mean, I don't know if I assume that's the reason for the Beis Abracious. And the rest of them, I can't explain that way. But the Beis Abracious, I assume, is for that reason. Yes. Rashi has a comment about a nun hafucha or something like that. He said, Ad Khan, there was until Avram, there was Charon Ach Ba'olam. Our nun is perfectly normal. As far as I know. I've never seen any different nun.
We say Kaddish.
I'm sorry?
We say Kaddish.
All right. Anyway, fine. I have a general rule I'll forgive you under these circumstances, but my rule is that when students want to make jokes, they have to be funny. When I make jokes, they don't have to be fun. They don't have to be funny. Now, you're not mechuyev to laugh at my jokes, and it won't help you on your grades if you do, but I'm the only one who's entitled not to make non-funny jokes. Okay, and you can just smirk and say, it's a good thing he doesn't quit his day job to do comedy. Okay, anyway. I'm sorry? Quit while you're behind. All right. Anyway, so now, what are these? So just a few things, comments about the various phenomena. The Gemara Nedarim, which I said I wasn't going to talk about, we'll take a very, very brief look at. The Gemara Nedarim, which is earlier, it should be source 23, page 23. Is it later? No, it's right on the previous page. So there the Gemara says, you have the Adam Ravika Brabana Machanan Rab Mai the Siva, Yikur Besef Haras Alakim Forash, Visom Sehel by Yavina Ba Mikra, this is Gemara Megillah also some of this. By Yikur Besef Haras Alakim is a Mikram, the Forash is a Targum, Visom Sehel, Elu Apsukim, by Yavina Ba Mikra is a Pisuk Ta'amim. So it's clear, the way Chazal understood the Pasuk in Ezra Nechemya, that they had some type of a Targum. It doesn't automatically have to mean they had, I mean, the Gemara Megillah does assume it's sort of our Targum. They have Trup. It doesn't mean that they have our Trup, but it means they have a system of Trup. And some say, V'amrila Eilu HaMasoros, which is what we would call the Masoretic activity. I mentioned last week, or week before, that there may be Masoretic activity. We may not have them anymore, but that probably the Masoretic activity, it certainly began in the time of the Gemara. It didn't start with the Baal HaMasor and Tfariyah, because the Gemara says, Lama Nikru HaRishonim Sofrim, Shayu Sofrim Kol Osi Yosha B'Torah. So you could argue it's Drush, and that's not why they were called Sofrim, but you know that by the time of Chazal, by the time of Amorayim, they were already counting letters. That they were already doing this. And there's no reason to assume that it wasn't going on earlier, even as early as Ezra's time. So the Masoretic activity is attributed by the Gemara there. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Mikra Sofrim, Ve'itra Sofrim, Ukrayim, Lotzivim, Ksivim, Lokayim, Halacha Moshe Misinai. What does he mean by these terms? It means the Kray of Sivs, Halacha Moshe Misinai. I assume what the Gemara, what he means is that the institution, the notion of a Kray of Sivs, is Halacha Moshe Misinai. Now it's still a little strange, because generally speaking, we don't assume, I guess by maybe Hakel, the only time you have a Kriya Satorah that's called Min HaTorah, that you talk about a Krayuk Siv, that you have a Din Daraisa, and I imagine it's Hakel. But I don't assume it necessarily means the Krayuk Sivs in the Vim and Ksuvim clearly do not emanate from Sinai, right? Books weren't around from Harsina. It means the notion, the institution of Krayuk Siv, and Mikra Sofrim and Itu Sofrim is Mitzinai. Okay. Anyway, so here you already have an attribution of the Masoretic activity beginning with Ezra Sofer. There's no way to prove it, but there's not necessarily reason to doubt it either. It's clear from the Gemara, you know, the Baal HaMemra, that his time they were already doing this. Finally, we have the work of the Baal HaMasorah. Now, in terms of our text, we've spoken about this a little bit already last week. How accurate are our texts, or how closely they reflect the original text? So we mentioned the Gemara. We mentioned the Gemara in Kiddushin about Haseres v'Seres, and that the numbers are very far off. One of the considerations that should be put forward, and I don't know if I suggested this last week, is there may have been different ways of counting, or they may in fact have had what we have as a snachas. They might have had a sof sukim. It doesn't explain letters, but it may explain sukkim. It also certainly may explain that bizarre statement that Sefer Tilim has like 5,000 sukkim or something like that in it, when it has really about half that. All right. Now, as far as trup are concerned, we know that there are trup floating around in the Amoraic period based upon this interpretation of Sefer Ezra. However, how fixed and rigid were those trup? So the very famous Gemara, it's in Yoma, I don't have the citation right here, Chamesh Mikra'o She'en Lahem Hechreya. Does that sound familiar? Five psukim which have no clear Hechreya where you put the comma. Oror Kam Meshuk Adin, Machar, and I think what the fifth one is. For example, Vayomer Moshe El Yoshua Becharlanu, Anashim v'tehi lachem amalek, machar anachi nitzav rosh hakeva matelechem yadim. Now, Pshat, I think, is clear. I don't know why they were so mesubach by these. But nonetheless, if you read it, v'tehi lachem amalek machar, and hine anachi nitzav... I know it's on amalek in our Sfarim.
Right, but
on Machar, do you read Tehi Lachem Amalek Machar? Anochi Nitzav Rosh HaGevah Matei Elokim Miyadi. Now, grammatically, it's a little awkward, but Chazal said the Mikra has no Hechreya. The only one I think that even you can make something that argument for as being truly ambiguous is Uvam Nora Arba Ogiviyim Meshukadim Kastarev Racha. The way our sharp reads is Uvam Nora Arba Ogiviyim. It's Nafta. Meshukadim Kastarev, which is a Meshukadim, what we call a. Misi Gaza Keith Katon and then so you could have read it in theory. A little bit difficult, but not impossible. Especially since in the other psukim there is so it's not unreasonable. So read it moving the Asnachta. Now Chazal say there's no Hechreya. I mean, it's not compelling which way it's to be read, which means that they don't have a received trop of esnacha on which words. It's that they're dividing up the psukim in logical fashion. And they felt that these five psukim, there was a degree of ambiguity. So it means to some extent that trop system is still a bit fluid. Okay. Certainly the Bali Masorah further developed the system, and they record the system in symbols. The system that they recorded is similar to that which we have today, although we have lost some of the distinctions that they used to have. In different communities, there are fewer, in Sephardic communities, for example, there are fewer distinctions between trop and the music to them than there are in Ashkenazic tradition, meaning there are a lot of trop, they do the same way. The truth is, trop has only basically three or four functions. You're either a nishares, you're attached to the next word, you're either a, or on the opposite end of the spectrum, you're either a kesar, a major break, a melech, a masik rishon, a masik sheni, a masik shlishi, I think is as far as they divide. But there are really only six trop in terms of their function of giving meaning to the pasuk. And trop does two things. It gives music, it allows for music, and it gives meaning. I'm not going to go into it now, but if you read Rav Breuer's Tameh HaMikra, it's a wonderful sefer. It's a question whether or not it's correct, but it's still, I think, the reigning theory in terms of how trop convey meaning and how trop break up a pasuk and the rules for why trop goes in certain places. And there actually is a system to the trop beyond the snap and so pasuk. There's actually a method to the madness. And it often will give you important. There are times where switching trop, if you accept his system, which I think is still the predominant view, there are many subtle occasions where changing the trop from one thing to another completely can completely change the meaning of the pasuk. Some of them should be obvious to you in the first place. If you reverse the mercha tipchana, you don't need a boy for that. Reverse the mercha tipchana tipcha mercha. Sometimes, not always, you can drastically change. What's that? That's a good example of it. Vayikrov, even though the Targum translates both the same way, but Vayikrov v'shem Hashem or Vayikrov v'shem Hashem. This week it's Vayikrov kama v'shem Hashem. In the Kriya of Tanis Tivo and Kisisa, it's Vayikra V'Shem Hashem, because there it's God did the calling. Whatever it means, God says to Moshe, V'Karasi V'Shem Hashem L'Fanecha. So there, Vayikra V'Shem, you don't want to say, it's not, and he called in the name of God, it's, and God called, whatever it means to call V'Shem. Vayikra V'Shem, and who was the subject of Vayikra? Hashem. Whereas in Lech Lecha, Vayikra, Avram called in the name of God. He prayed to God or something like that. And the trop is different, and you correct on that. If your Baal Kriya reads, this week he's probably going to read it right, but if he reads it wrong, Kisisa, you send it back for it. It changes the meaning. Yeah? Correct. Very important. It's Saluka Feres, Tumayim. Right. Now, you have to know, understand something about the trop there. Is very important. Not only forget the comma there. If the person were to read a Darga Sevir on Saluka Oferes, talk how it works. Now, talk of the, see, that's a case where the limit, there are limitations in the trust. Yeah, in fact, the trust there doesn't follow the meaning. The trust there suggests that the waters were mighty.
Well,
yes, it does. You have to read Rav Breuer, you'll see. I understand what you're saying, and I'm telling you that based upon Rav Breuer's system, which usually bears itself out, Saluka Feres is the rightmost melech is the first major break. So it's Saluka Feres and B'mayim Adirim. If you wanted to make it Saluka Feres B'mayim Adirim, you would have been Darga Sevir, because the Sevir is not a Melech, and the Tipcha is a Melech. You have to read his first chapter. It's a summary of the book.
Which
word? Tameh HaNekor, Mordechai Breuer, from Gush. They're actually, I think they're cousins or something, but it's the one who's not a youngster anymore and teaches Tanakh and the Mahon or whatever in Gush. Yeah, I'm sorry? You're done. It's not, if you read his thing, you'll see. It should not have been a Zakeh Katam. Anyway. Okay. As I said, I have strange interests. Alright. Anyway, let's take a brief look. A couple things. The Bali Masorah, there are really three things among the Masoretic notes. There are the notes in the margins, because a codex was written in columns, or even if it was a single column, there are notes in the margins. That's called the Masorah Katana. They're very short. Why are they short? Not enough room. Then when you have them written sometimes, I don't know which they call in the bottom or maybe in the back of the sefer, you have the Masorah Gedola. It's either the Masorah Magna or the Masorah Parva, they call it. Okay, Magna is large. And that's more expansive notes. What you might frequently get on the side, if you have a word that occurs in a certain form three times in Tanakh, you'll get a little circle on the word, and it will say in the margin, Gimel, it means three times. If it says Lamed, does anyone know what that means? Don't answer the obvious, not 30 times. It stands for Lesa, means nowhere else, like this. The only time. The most common Masoretic note probably is Lamed, Lesa. I mean, this form is unique. It doesn't mean it's the only occurrence of the root. It might be just the only spelling that way, the only Male Chaser, or various other things. But they tend to be very short notes because there's not enough room. In the Masorah Gedola, you get more expanded versions. There are also separate books, Masoretic books, the most famous of which, the Tan quotes, Achla Ve'Achla, which give you lists of confusable passages in the Tanakh where you might get, you know, one place the word, one Achla, one is Ve'Achla, and things like that. If you read Ben Chashai again, which is a fun thing for strange people to do, but or Bali Kriya, who really want to make sure they're doing their job. I'm sorry? You do have it in the right edition. I didn't bring it with me. Which Oh, okay. Does he have all the Masorah or only some? Okay, so so the Mincha Shai in the back, some tikkun have been, he has the Masoretic notes on Mincha Shai. There's the tikkun Mincha Shai. Okay, that's not the Masorah. Mincha Shai quotes a lot of these things. He quotes a lot of fun sinanim. They were very creative people. Anyway, so you get these three things: Masorah Gedola, Masorah Ktana, and separate books. What does Masorah mean? What does Mem Samach Reish mean? So you think it means to hand over, which is a possibility. It's one of the possibilities that's suggested. There also is, I believe, an Arabic root, which Mem Samach Reish means to count. And that seems to me the most logical interpretation, right? Because Lama Nikru Harishonim Sofrim Shahayumonim Kol Osir Shabbatara. Others have suggested that Masorah is a shortened form of Me'aser, which is the bundle. Okay? Or you even get it without, you get it with the Aleph, La'esor Malchayhem Bezikim, right? To tie them up, to bundle them up. Okay? fine. Some are not marked. If they're so common. I skipped a thought. Cray of sieves are noted usually one way or the other. You'll see in the margin, kuf, cray, and then the way it's supposed to be red. Very common crays are not red. And they are, some of them are, he, for who, when it's written Hevav Aleph, Na'ar Na'ara, because most of them are like that, Yerushalayim, there's a few exceptions, is written how? The way it's spelled in Aramaic, Yerushalayim. Shem Hashem. And finally, my favorite, which I like to rail about, is Yisachar. You'll forgive my irreverence here, but I know some people may come from places where they read it the first time. Some read it every time, both ways. Some read it only until Parshas Pinchas, and there's a medrash about that, because Yashuv, Yisachar's son in Vayigash, is Yov. And in Pinchas he's Yashuv, so they say he gave up his shin to Yov there. I have to say that reading in such a fashion borders on neo-charism or Tfira b'Masorah. All about there were three schools of thought, and what's the wrong way they read it along with it? Yisachar. Are there any Bostonians here? What do you do in Boston? The Talmud? No, I don't know what they do in the Talmud.
No idea.
No idea. I know in Maimonides, and the Rav had this thing. I will tell you the story, and this is not men chas hashalom with disrespect. Professor Bernstein told me that his father, who the Rav would probably have identified as his Rebbe in Bichduk, his father told him, you follow the Rav in everything except for this. The Rav had the practice of all the time reciting Yisachar both ways as if it were a suffix. It's not a suffix. What's that? Who said this? Oh, okay, but the fact is as follows. Firstly, we have three known records of how you read the word Yisachar from the Baal HaMasorah. The correct way, correct means the one we follow always is Ben Asher, is to read it as a creative, one sin is silent. Yisachar, period. That's what the Ramah quotes, Ibn Ezra, Radat, all the Mizrachai, all the Gedolim in the Sora, Afar Yisrael, all said, period, end of discussion, nothing to talk about. But if you thought there was another way to read it, we have two other readings. One belongs to a name you've also might have heard if you know a little bit, Ben Naphtali, who was still from basically the same school in Tveria, and then from another Baal Masara, where we have some Geniza fragment, whose name is Moshe Moche. I don't know if we know much about him. Okay, and their two readings, I don't remember which is which, one of them read it as Yish-Sachar, and the other one read it as, I believe, Yis-Sachar. Okay, I forget what the set with Thoron is. Nobody, read none of the Baalei Masora read it as Yis-Sachar. So it seems to me that A, to have people read it both ways is wrong, because you've read it all three ways, and the second way which they're reading it is completely wrong. It's none of the above. There is, however, bottom line is, there is no suffix about this word. I mean, there were different opinions among the Baalei Masora. The word is Yis-Sachar, that's how you read it. You know, to do so otherwise is, you know, it's no different than any other word that you could decide that could be an alternative reading. And there are other words, by the way, in Tanakh, which have a similar phenomenon of a double consonant where only one is pronounced. Some of them are Yud, but you have a famous one. The Mechashai quotes them all. And you look the first time, and look at Mechashai, the first time you have Yis-Sachar, he'll quote them. You have Mechatzrim, where it's Mechatzrim or something like that, spelled with two tzadis, you only read one. You also have, if you look at Mechuyael, Mechiyael, one of those in Parashas Bereishis is the same pattern, actually, of two Yuds where one is actually silent. Even though there are two Yuds there, and there really should have been something double pronounced. Okay, so anyway, so we have Masoretic information on Yis-Sachar, and there's only one way. And the Ben Usher is clear, and the other two ways are the way they are. And all the Chachmei Masora of the Rishonim and Achronim are basically Sebe Pe'echa, that you follow, you read it Yis-Sachar, one sin is silent, it's a Kreuk sin. However, it's not noted every time. In fact, how do you know it's a Kreuk? How do you know that you're supposed to read it that way? What's the tip-off that you read it Yis-Sachar? Because one of the sins has what under it? Nothing. If it had a shva, it would be read Yis-Sachar or Yis-Sachar. It has nothing under it, and therefore that's an indication that it's read silently. Just as I pointed out last week, the difference between Pidatzur and Pidael. I'll still talk to you if you read Yis-Sachar both ways, but it's not correct.
It's not
I understand. I'm just pointing out that this is... It started with a... I think it became popularized by a Hasidic rabbi, I forget who it was, the Bnei Yis-Sachar. I don't know who the author is. What's that?
So this is the first time, like,
they
went away and the rest of them?
That minhag doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. That's what when I came to the school that I daven in, supposedly it was the official minhag, but it has slowly dissipated. In fact, I my son's bar mitzvah parasha got over with Bian Bayetze, and I had, with the rabbi agreed, I would have him read a different week rather than read the first time Yis-Sachar. So, however, rabbi's okay with it. There's nothing kaddish about reading it, your bar mitzvah Shabbos. You can read the next week, but there's something kaddish about reading it properly. Okay. Okay. So hopefully you ignored him, or if you were too young to ignore him because he frightened you. But anyway, but that minhag doesn't really make a lot of sense. That was not the Rav's. I mean, I think he picked it up. He's actually Talmud of the Rav. But the Rav's minhag, I believe, was all the time was to treat it as if it were a suffix or something like that. Again, I don't. It's not. But at least if you can argue it's a suffix, you do it all the time. And then there's this third minhag of you do it up to Parshas Pinchas, which I find the funniest, but cute, but not a reason to read a pasuk that way. Okay, but we have to take a little time on Masoretic notes, because if I give you a little thing on the Bechina, so you want to at least have some familiarity. Now, this, if you're interested in reading, but we don't have time, is the Isaiah scroll. You can compare it to the Yeshayah. This is a photograph, a Xerox of the facsimile of the Aleppo Codex. And look in the margins. Let's start, for example, on the right side, top line. Hashem Sako Shemo Va'asim Devarai. What does that letter say? Can anyone see? Well, it's Hey Rachesh. It happens to be Hey Chaser. Hey is two words. Hey Chaser. There are five times in Tanakh Va'asim. And usually it's the exact form. It's not going to be Tosin Yosim. Only a Va'asim. Okay? It's going to be written Chaser Yud. Alright, look in the next time. Next line. The Sicha Uvetzel. That word appears three times probably in Tanakh. Uvetzel. Tzel may appear more than three times, but Uvetzel. I mean, it's not so unusual, but they count it. They're trying to protect the text. Okay, the Leimor L'Tzion. Gimel times, is Lamar only appear three times in Tanakh? No, but Zilamar, which is unusual, appears only three times. It makes sense, by the way, in this context, because it's being used completely, somewhat differently than Aydav Hashem or Shalimar, but nonetheless, they noted that. His Orevi. Right, now I'm trying to remember if these are the two times here, or if it's repeated one other place. I think these might be the only two times. There is another simon on Uri. You can't see it here, but it's not on this page, is it? Uri Lakshiv. It is. Just go over to the next column. Uri, it's on the bottom probably. So look at turn the page. Well, what you get on the left, we'll have an easier time reading this.
It's on the top. It's like an
line. Okay, well, turn the page anyway. It'll be easy to read. This is sort of a very standard printing. I don't know what they have. There's a Varsha printing in Tanakh, and there's another one. I don't remember which this is. There's this text and then the Malbim text. The Malbim text that they typically print with doesn't have the Masoretic notes. This does. So if you're normal, you like the Malbim text better because everything is clear and block. If you're strange like me, you like this text better because you have the Masoretic notes. So there, if you go down a little bit, a little easy to read here, the bottom line, Uri, three lines from the bottom of the Hebrew, so you have Dalid Dikavaseh. What does Dikavaseh mean? Like it. Four places in Tanakh. Uri, in fact, in one of them, you have two in the same pasuk with different accents. Uri Dabrishir, and there's one other place we have Uri. Let's go from the top. Uftiyeh Hashem Yeshuvun, I don't know if that's a Yid or a Vav, but it's either 10 or 6 times that the word Yeshuvun occurs. V'simchas Olam HaRosham, so it says Yud Zugin Mishalfen. Okay, what I assume that means, actually I'm not sure what that means, V'simchas Olam. There is, I would have thought actually it's on the next one. Yasi Gun, you have a very similar pasuk earlier in Yeshaya, and it's probably these two psukim get confused probably. Simchas Olam or Sham, probably like Yeshaya Lamed Gimel or something like that. 10 pairs of where you have psukim, very similar psukim that appear in two places. Okay, and they get confused with minor differences. Sasom Simcha Yasi Gun, the early one is Yasigu with no nun. Here he writes Lesa, and what's the next thing? Umilael. Excuse me. It's the accent's on the last syllable. The earlier one in Ishai is Yasigu. It's an Ila'el. Going on, Anochi Anochi, it says Gimel, what do you think that means? Three times you get the words paired. Then you get Umi Ben, okay, and what does it say? It says Beis, and then it says Chamishim Shana. You want to take a crack at what that means? The word Umi Ben only appears twice, and what's the other occurrence? It's Umi Ben Chamishim Shana. Right? Umi Ben Chamishim Shana Yashuv Mitzvah Odavale Evodot. Sometimes they give you a brief reference to the pasuk, which the other one is. Okay, going down the line, Shem Osef Anotesh Shemayim Yosei Orek, it says, base times that you have Noteh, and Vichos, I'm sorry, Osefa is the first one, Osefa, and it's Vichoser. Okay, I don't know if the other one is chaser as well, but you have to check that. Okay, noteh, there's no note on noteh. I don't know what the circle is about, unless it's in the right margin. Then you have the word aret, and you have yud dalid kam and a kamat under it. What do you think that means? Normally it's eret, but 14 times in Tanakh the word eret appears as aret. Okay, and the word, next line, hamitzik. What does it say? Beis. And Bapasuk, which probably means the word Hamitzik occurs only twice in Tanakh, and it's in this pasuk. If you look down to, go down a while, sort of halfway down, you see the two lamas, you see five lamas in fact. Okay, Mikol Banim Kidela Lamed, which means again, Lesa, only twice in Tanakh. The same thing for Korah Osayan, the same thing going down a couple lines for Ulafu, the same thing for Kiso Mihmar. Ushchuras, go down two more lines. It says Lesa the Chaser. Okay, never occurs elsewhere, and it's written Chaser. We'll do one more, and we'll stop with that. Koamar Adonai Hashem. It says Shnayim Ki Hu Adonai Hishtachav Yilai. I think it's Tilim and Vav. So Mizmar Kokudas Melach Panima. What does that mean? It means the word Adonai appears only twice, and the other one is in that pasuk. Okay, the net result of all these Masoretic notes is it's easy to check mistakes in the text. perfect? No. Why? Because if it tells you that the word aret appears 14 times with the comma, and you're not sure about two places, well, now you don't really know. You know 13 of them, and you don't know which the 14th is. But if it's only one pasuk that you have a suffix about, so then you go check if you have 14 others, and you often get them in lists. But even if you don't, you go check 14 others. If you don't have 14 others, you know this is it. If you do have 14 others, you know that it's aret. Yes.